Thomas Jefferson once said, "In matters of principle, stand like a rock." With that in mind, what does it take to stand on principle when the pressure to compromise builds up? John MacArthur helps you live an uncompromising life with today's lesson on Grace to You. Flip-flopper, you probably have heard that term during this election season. It's meant to disparage politicians willing to change their position on issues. In other words, it helps them politically. Of course, you don't have to be in politics to flip-flop, say, on your beliefs. Maybe you found yourself tempted to compromise your Christian convictions in the things that you say, the decisions you make, or relationships you keep, what you read, watch, or listen to. Dangerous territory. So, how do you stand on convictions under light pressure and heavy pressure when consequences are minor or serious? The story of Daniel in the lion's den shows you how to live with that conviction. So let's join John MacArthur now here on today's Grace to You as he continues the study called An Uncompromising Life.
We're looking at Daniel chapter 6, the famous chapter in which we find Daniel in and out of the lion's den. Just as an introduction, let me make a couple of comments relative to what we'll learn in the text. Nations rise, nations fall, they come and go. But the Bible tells us in Acts 17 that the times of the nations are bounded by the sovereignty of God. And what happens to the nations is all in the predetermined plan of God for history. And what is especially thrilling is that the coming and the going of nations has very little to do with the ongoing of the people of God. There couldn't be imagined a more cataclysmic event than just happened in chapter 5 of Daniel. Babylon has fallen. At the height of its glory, supposedly the head of gold, the greatest empire that humanity had ever known, the Medes and the Persians entered the city, and without firing a shot, as it were, the whole empire fell. But what is amazing about it is that it had little or no impact on what God did with His people, for Daniel rides through the ebb and the flow of nations. And as we come to chapter 6, we enter the second in the great four empires seen in the image of Daniel chapter 2, the Medo-Persian Empire, the breast and the arms of silver. And as we look at that empire, we don't see Daniel in absentia, but we see Daniel right at the heart of the matter. He was a prime minister of Babylon, and he will equally be the prime minister of Medo-Persia. And it excites me to think about that, because I see today across America and even around the world a preoccupation among many Christian peoples with the preservation of certain nations, even our own. And in a strange way, they are attempting to equalize America with the church or America with the plan of God, and that just isn't the way it is. Nations come and go, and God's work goes on. And no nation is really significant when set against the backdrop of eternity and God's plan. When God sets about to weigh out the history of humanity, the nations are not the issue. And when God pours out the floods of the flow of His redemptive plan, one drop is inconsequential. The nations are drops, they are dust. In chapter 4 of Daniel in verse 17, you'll remember that great word, "This matter is by the decree of the watchers and the demand by the word of the holy ones to the intent that the living may know that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men and gives it to whomsoever He will." God rules in history, and nations may come and nations may go, even our own. But God's redemptive plan as unfolded through His people will go on according to schedule. The people of God go through the rise and the fall of nations. They transcend. That's a great hope for us. And we see that in Daniel. Babylon is fallen. The head of gold is crushed. The times of the Gentiles has moved into phase 2. But Daniel is right where God wants him. And God is unencumbered by the decisions of men. So it is with the world. But God's people and God's plan transcends all that. So we see Daniel surviving. And in chapter 6, we find him in the midst of the Medo-Persian empire. Now, I want some keywords to take us through this text. We're going to begin at the beginning of chapter 6. It's a narrative text. We don't need to spend a lot of time on each section. We want to get to the climax and then draw some practical implications. But we're going to use some keywords just to help us keep our place as we go. The first one is promotion. Promotion. And that deals with verses 1 to 3. It pleased Darius to set over the kingdom, this is the Medo-Persian kingdom, and 120 princes who should be over the whole kingdom. And over these, three presidents, and by the way, that's the only place in the Bible that word president is ever used in the Hebrew, or the Aramaic rather, and it appears to be a word that means chief. He set over these 120 satraps, or territorial leaders, three chiefs to whom they reported, of whom Daniel was first, in order that the princes might give accounts unto them and the king should have no damage. Then this Daniel was preferred above the presidents and princes because an excellent spirit was in him, and the king thought to set him over the whole realm. Now there we find the promotion. Notice first of all that we meet Darius. Now Darius is a very elusive person because we have no extra biblical data in existence to tell us anything about Darius. We just really don't know who he is. We find nobody at that particular point in history who's named Darius. There doesn't seem to be a place in the genealogical record of the kings of that time for a man named Darius. Now, some scholars feel that Darius is just another name for Cyrus. Just another name for Cyrus. I feel that that's perhaps the best explanation of all. Why? Because the word Darius is a title. It is a title. It's kind of like Pharaoh or King or Caesar. It's a title. We find the word Darius, for example, used on inscriptions in archaeology for at least five different Persian rulers. They're all called Darius. So it seems best to see this as a title of honor, a title of significance. And so we could assume then that it is just a title given to Cyrus. Now, if you back up into chapter 6, you find that Darius sets over the kingdom 120 princes. And it seems to me that if he were doing that, he would have to be bigger than some localized ruler in Babylon. And if he was going to establish three chiefs over the whole kingdom, he'd have to be somebody pretty important. I believe he is seen then as the Medo-Persian monarch Cyrus, just by another official title. The very fact that he had to set up 120 princes would indicate that he had to have a broader dimension of rule than just Babylon itself, just the city-state of Babylon. So we meet then this man, Cyrus, perhaps best seen behind the name Darius. He is a capable man. He is an intelligent man. He is an effective man in terms of organization and structure. He's a powerful man. He's a man without commitment to God. That is the God of Israel, but to his own gods. And yet he is a man who does indicate some great interest in the God of Daniel. And that increases as we get through this sixth chapter. Now notice that it says that when he appointed the 120 and the three presidents, verse 2 says Daniel was first. It is possible to see the word first as just the word one. Daniel was one. Or we could see it as the word first, and meaning that he was the first one chosen, or he was the first in rank. It really doesn't matter. What does matter is in verse 3, that Daniel was preferred above everybody else. And the word preferred in the Aramaic is a participle, which means he was distinguishing himself constantly over the others. He was without question the finest statesman in the entire Medo-Persian Empire, as he had been the finest statesman in the Babylonian Empire, as he perhaps is the finest statesman who ever walked on the face of the earth. You'll notice in verse 3 it says that in him was an excellent spirit. That's really talking about his attitude. And of course, attitude pervades everything we do. This is a commendable thing, a right attitude. But Daniel had more than that going for him. He had experience. I mean, he had lived through the last regime as the prime minister. He had wisdom, wisdom like nobody else had. He had a sense of history. He had apparently dramatic leadership ability, if what he was able to do in the lives of the three young men early in the book is any indication of the model that he set. He had administrative ability and was given responsibility on a wide and far-reaching basis. And beyond all of that, he had the ability to interpret dreams and visions and give everybody an idea of what was coming in the future, and that's invaluable to a monarch. What a man. God put him right where he wanted him. God allowed Darius to recognize the capability of Daniel and to put him in a very strategic place, a place of influence. You know, what's interesting is in the first year of Cyrus, or the first year of Darius, he gave a decree that the Jews could go back to Judah. The decree of Cyrus, the 70 years of Babylonian captivity was up, and Cyrus gave that decree that he go back, that the Jews go back. And I really believe that Daniel was the one who was the great influence on him to that extent. I think it was because of the power of the life of Daniel, because of the wisdom of the man, because of the influence of the man, that even in the first year of Cyrus' rule, around 538 or 537 BC, he made the decree to let the people go. And that occurred before the Lion's Den incident, in the very first year of Cyrus. So we see again Daniel. But this time, rather than looking at him as a young man, as we have been in the past, we see him as a very old man. In fact, mark this, in chapter 6, Daniel is pushing hard at 90 years of age. 90 years of age. And he's still God's man. He's still God's choice. And he was still the choice of the king to be the prime minister. And God put him right where he wanted him, and the politics of Medo-Persia had little to do to withstand it. Second word. The first is promotion, the second is plot. Verses 4 to 9. Whenever a man is lifted up by the Lord to a place of prominence, he falls into certain difficulty. There's always a price to pay, and that is the fact that whenever you get into that position, you will find yourself dogged and hounded and followed by envy. It's just the way it is. We find it in Philippians chapter 1, don't we, where Paul was in prison and some were adding affliction to his bonds by saying evil things about his ministry. They wanted to make him feel worse than he did being a prisoner. They were preaching Christ contentiously as a negative ministry against Paul. It's amazing how when God lifts up somebody, other people's hearts burn in rage and jealousy and bitterness, even when that individual has done them no injury and absolutely no harm. How could anybody hate Daniel? How could anybody despise such a man? I'll ask you a tougher question. How could anybody crucify Jesus Christ? But they did. In London, contemporary with young Charles Spurgeon was an older preacher who'd been in the city for a generation. He'd spent years laboring faithfully in his ministry. And along came Charles Haddon Spurgeon, this fiery, winsome, young, dynamic individual who arrived at London when he was about 20 years of age. And rather immediately, I mean, not even in a year or two or three, but immediately when he hit the scene, he had such an impact that people just flooded to hear Spurgeon preach. He was like a star that appeared in the sky, just flashing. And the older minister said that when the throngs began to crowd around the young man, envy and jealousy began to enter my heart, and it ate me up. It ate me up. There he was, a famous preacher in London, but the throngs were listening to Spurgeon. And the older pastor said he got on his knees and cried out before God, and he told the Lord all about it. And then he said the Lord began to put in his heart praise and intercession and pleading for the young man, Spurgeon. He said, quote, "The day came after I prayed and took it to God when upon every victory Spurgeon won, I felt as though I had done it myself." God gave him victory, but it doesn't always happen. Let's see the opposite of that as we look at verse 4. "Then the presidents and princes sought to find occasion against Daniel concerning the kingdom, but they could find no occasion nor fault, for as much as he was faithful, neither was there any error or fault found in him." Daniel had no water gates. He had no skeletons in his closet. There was no way to indict this man. Now, when a man is 90 years old and he gets all of the people in political office around him digging around to try to find something and they come up with zero, that's an honorable man. Great integrity, great honesty, great purity, great nobility. They found no fault, shahita, which means to corrupt, no corruption, no error, shalu, which means to neglect. In other words, the corruption is the sin of commission, And the error is the sin of omission. They couldn't find anything he did that he shouldn't have done and anything that he didn't do that he should have done. What a virtuous man. They couldn't find anything. Verse 5, then said these men, we shall not find any occasion against this Daniel, except we find it against him concerning the law of his God. Now, people, I wish we had time to just preach on that verse. When they can't find anything against you but the fact that you are absolutely sold out to your God, then you are fulfilling the fact of the New Testament principle of suffering for righteousness' sake. The only thing they said we'll ever get him on is that he is totally committed to his God. What a commendation. They couldn't find anything else. If there was anything, they would have found it, and they couldn't. Verse 6, then these presidents and princes assembled together to the king, and thus they said unto him, King Darius, live forever. Typical amenities. Every time you come in there, you got to say that. Daniel even says that in the lion's den. It's pushing the point a little bit. But anyway, verse 7, all the presidents of the kingdom, the governors, the princes, the counselors, and the captains have consulted together. Now, that's just pure intimidation because it's a lot of hogwash. There was a group of them that made a plot. Not all of them agreed, but just stacking up all of those individuals, just intimidated, and they all consulted, they said, to establish a royal statute and make a firm decree that whosoever shall ask a petition of any god or man for 30 days except of thee, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions. You've heard of queen for a day. This is king for 30 days. We want you to be God for 30 days. Now, when you can be elected to be God, you got bad theology. And when you're only God for 30 days, it's even worse theology. Here they come in. We have consulted all the governors and the princes and the presidents and the counselors and the captains, and everybody has agreed we ought to make a law. You're so wonderful, and you are worthy of 30 days of being God. And we're going to give you that privilege. And we just want to make a rule here that whoever shall ask a petition of any god or man for 30 days, unless it's you, shall be cast into the den of lions. It's interesting here that if you look back at verse 6, there's a verb there, assembled together. It's a very interesting verb in the Aramaic. It means they came hastily and tumultuously. It's kind of like a rabble. I mean, they were kind of a tumultuous group. They were stirring and milling as they came in. A very strong verb, and it does indicate a large group of them who had pulled off this plot. But not everybody agreed, because Daniel was the leader and he didn't agree. I'm sure he wasn't even consulted. So they all come in and pull off their lie when they said all the presidents. That's not true. There was one of them who didn't agree, who didn't even know, perhaps. We want to make a statute and a firm decree. And by the way, the double use of that, a royal statute and a firm decree, shows you how binding and strong they wanted it to be, that nobody but nobody can worship or make a petition of anybody but you for 30 days. By the way, in those days, of course, their religion had established deities that were like men. Their deities were as fallible as men were. In other words, they made their image of God from their own image. And so their gods were fallible. And so to say that a man could be a god to us is absolutely ludicrous, because God is holy and righteous and perfect and has none of the imperfections of humanity. But for them, it wasn't a problem. In fact, if we study history carefully, we'll find that the Egyptians believed that the pharaohs were gods, that the Romans believed that the Caesars were gods, the Ptolemies were believed to be gods. There are indications that the Seleucids acclaimed the role of deity. Even the Herods, you remember in Acts 12, took the place of gods. So that it was not uncommon for monarchs to do this. Well, Darius was flattered. I mean, when you get the whole body politic coming in and wanting to do that for you, boy, that's pretty tough to resist. And so he wasn't thinking. He was swept away in the emotion of the whole deal. Verse 8, now, O king, establish the decree and sign the writing that it be not changed according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which altereth not. Now, we don't know a whole lot about the law of the Medes and Persians, except we do know that once you made the law, you couldn't violate it. That was built into their system. And most studies indicate that the reason they did that was to prevent whimsical laws. That once a law was made, it was binding, and so they were rather careful about those laws. But when these guys came along and hit this king at the point of his vulnerability, his ego, he responded. Verse 9, he signed the writing and the decree. Now there was a law. You make a petition of any God but this God, and you go to the lion's den.
That's John MacArthur, president of the Master's College and Seminary, with a compelling look today at what you can learn from Daniel in the Lion's Den. This lesson, a part of the current study on Grace to You, titled An Uncompromising Life. Again, the study makes it clear Christians are always going to face pressure to compromise what they believe to accommodate the secular culture. So, John, how can our listeners prepare to face that temptation and stand firm on biblical principles?
You know, at the end of the day, and sort of at the end of the line, what allows people to be uncompromising and courageous with the things that they know are true is the absence of any fear. If you fear rejection by certain people, you may become mute and hide your convictions. If you feel you might lose a friendship, you might alienate a family member, you might make an enemy at work or school. And even worse, if you fear you could lose your job, if you fear, at the end of the line, persecution, and by the way, that is ramping up with fierce speed in our country. Christians will be persecuted. We've had a reprieve for a few hundred years. That is over. The persecution has begun. And if you're afraid of persecution or afraid of alienation or afraid of losing a friend or afraid of not being popular, you compromise. But if your fear is of dishonoring God, dishonoring Christ, being unfaithful to the Word of God, the truth of God, if you fear that, then you will be faithful. It comes down to who you want to please. And of course, if you're a Christian, you must please the Lord at all costs. I want to offer you a CD message called The Power of Persecution. Persecution can be powerful in your life for good and for God's glory and for your usefulness. The subject of the message, The Power of Persecution, will send it free to any of you who ask. Do it today.
Friend, if neighbors or coworkers, even family members, ridicule your beliefs, or you live in a place where physical violence against Christians is common, this message can help you respond to persecution in a way that honors Christ. The title of that free CD lesson, The Power of Persecution. Contact us here today to get your copy.
Call us weekdays from 9:30 to 5 GMT. Our free phone number for UK calls, 0800-389-3958. And from anywhere in Europe, reach us at 0044-1233-662-262. Now you're going to want to visit our website, that's gty.org.uk. It's loaded with free content, including hundreds of articles and Q&As on subjects vital to the Christian life. Grace to You's website also offers apps for your mobile devices, podcasts, and 3,000 full-length sermons by John MacArthur. And from there, you can order John's New Testament commentaries, topical books like The Gospel According to Jesus, and the MacArthur Study Bible. So go to gty.org.uk, check out all that's available, and check back often. Again, gty.org.uk, or call from anywhere in Europe, 0044 1233 662 262. And thanks for remembering, we depend on support from listeners like you. Through your giving, you help bring the life-changing power of God's Word to your nation. Now, on behalf of John MacArthur and the entire staff, be here next time, won't you, for another half hour of unleashing God's truth, one verse at a time, on Grace to You. Invite a friend to tune in next time. It's a great way to learn and grow together with Bible teacher John MacArthur on Grace to You.